If you were here last week, Chris Wright started this series off way back in the Old Testament in the book of Jeremiah, and we saw that if we're looking for God, then we need to look at ourselves, we need to look at our hearts and look at our expectations. And today we pick up this book. The book we'll be with the next few Sunday evenings, John's Gospel, written for those looking for God. But also written for those who wouldn't necessarily speak of themselves in those terms. They might think of themselves as living for God, or even speaking for God, as handling the issues of discipleship and whichever. John has things to teach us, and they've stood the test of time. So I want 20 minutes of your minds for tonight while we start to explore some of those things. Let me pray. And then we'll do just that. Gracious God, clear our minds, we pray. Open our eyes. May we see truth and wonderful things from your word. Amen. Jonathan Sacks was the chief rabbi until 2013. His latest book, I think, is called Not in God's Name. And I've just started reading it, and I was my eye was caught by this provocative comment of his. He wrote this: "The 21st century has left us with a maximum of choice and a minimum of meaning." He explained what he meant. He was speaking about a secular society, really. And he said, if there's one thing the great institutions of the modern world do not do, it's to provide meaning. Science tells us how, but not why. Technology gives us power, but cannot guide us as to how to use that power. He says that the market gives us choices, but leaves us uninstructed as to how to make those choices. The liberal democratic state gives us freedom to live as we choose, but on principle refuses to guide us as to how to choose. So he says science, technology, markets, liberal democracy, great achievements, but they do not and cannot answer the three questions every reflective individual will ask at some time in their life. Who am I? Why am I here? How then should I live? And so he says the result is the 21st century has left us with a maximum of choice and a minimum of meaning. And then he throws in this extra line. He speaks about how Homo sapiens, as a humanity, is the meaning-seeking animal. Well, if he's right, it begins to explain why so many feel a dissonance about life, a sense of not fitting in, of living in the dark, as it were. And if once there seemed to be clear answers to the questions of meaning, now life feels increasingly encrypted for people. Here's John Drain, a professor at Aberdeen University. He says that most people I meet still believe that somewhere, if only you could crack the code, there is something you can rely on, something you can trust and believe in. Why else do you think people spend so much of their time going to mediums, tarot card readers, and all the rest of it? They're searching for something. They believe it's there, but it's hidden, and you need to get the right way in. Well, I guess Bletchley Park was the famous World War II code-breaking centre where the Enigma code was cracked, which made such a difference to the war effort. Asa Briggs, one of our best-known historians, died earlier this year, and we held a memorial service for him here in All Souls last month. He was a remarkable man, and as you often do around funerals, you discover all kinds of things you never knew about someone. One of the things I discovered about Asa Briggs was that he had been a codebreaker at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. Chatting with his widow, she told me that she didn't know anything about it until after they'd been married for at least 20 years. Now, that was how seriously they took the Official Secrets Act they'd signed. Well, we're picking up a book here where the author's got no such inhibitions. He wants everyone to know his codebreaker, even if he introduces him by a code name, the Word. John's sure that if we're looking for God, the Word is the place to start, whoever we are. For it quickly becomes clear, the story John has to tell is, well, it's a universal story. See how he starts. In the beginning was the Word. In the beginning. See, the Word was in on it all from the start. If you noticed, it's a personal narrative. It speaks of he and him, not it. This isn't sort of Star Wars, like in the beginning was the Force. It's not one of those stories that land up with the kind of talk that says, you know, the universe wants us to think this or do that. Now, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. See, if anyone knows the meaning and can crack the code of the cosmos, the Word can. I remember once being interviewed by a journalist. He was writing a piece on an organization I'd belonged to, and we spoke a little bit about it, and then he started trying out some ideas on me about what he thought might have been the aims and the motives of the people who put it together. And he'd obviously got his favorite one that he put in front of me, and he said, you know, did I think that fitted? I said, I thought it was very plausible, but it's complete nonsense. He was obviously a little bit hurt about that, and he said, look, it's credible enough to me. Why do you think it's nonsense? How can you say that? I said, well, I was at the first meeting of this organization. I heard them talk. I said, as a matter of fact, I was at the planning meeting that planned the launch of the organization. To be strictly honest, I was even at the meeting that decided who would come to the planning meeting. So I said, it's a wonderful sounding idea, but it's complete nonsense. Those thoughts didn't cross anyone's mind, and I should know. Well, so should the Word. He was even more involved than that at the beginning. John 1, this passage that Caroline read for us, it's a familiar reading, isn't it, at Christmas carol services? But when you think about it, it's not great at telling the Christmas story. Yeah, it's kind of Christmas without any decorations. It's Christmas without a stable. No sheep. No cows. None of the zoo full of animals nativity plays have, for that matter. No shepherds. No wise men. No angels, even. Not even a genealogy. Well, we don't even look back to discover, you know, who the ancestors were. There's no talk of a mum or a dad. Not even a long list of carpenters he came from. You know, the way most biographies start, going back a generation or two. If you're looking for God, this is a research project with an almost infinite backward look. If you're talking about God, don't start with Christmas. See, I don't know how you think of the earth, whether you think of a young earth or an old earth or an in-between earth, but you're not going to explain it beginning a mere 2,000 years ago. And the Word's story doesn't begin at Christmas either. See, we Christians often shrink our faith by starting with Christmas. And then others pick up the habit and they shrink it in different ways. You know, people who talk as if, they say, oh, Christianity, of course, that's a Western religion, isn't it? If I'm feeling grumpy now, whenever I hear that, I say, oh, haven't you done any history? You know, it just ignores hundreds of years of history. Now, mind you, last week I was in Kazakhstan. If you're out in Kazakhstan, they think Christianity is a Russian religion. It came when they invaded with the Russian Orthodox Church, as they think. Now, here, in the beginning was the Word. And by verse 3, through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. See, this isn't a story for a sect. It's not a story to give meaning for a religious few. This is for all. This is your story. It's my story. It's the earth's story. It's the cosmos' story. This is the universal story. It's more than just that, of course. It's also a creation story. Now, you don't need to know much of the Bible, do you, to realize John is echoing how it all began. In the beginning, God created. The first words of the first book of the Bible, Genesis. In the beginning was the Word. John starts here, and he immediately pulls into his story so many who would read it. For the Greek-speaking world, the Greek-thinking world of his day, the Word was thought of as the power, the principle that organized the world, put it together. For the Jew, the Old Testament reader, the Word was a reminder that how God speaks is how God acts. It's like meeting God himself. You know, I don't know if you've read the first pages of the Bible, but there is a rhythm to the creation account in Genesis. There are phrases that keep getting repeated. And God said, and God said, and God said, and it was so, and it was so, and it was so. And God said, let there be light, and it was so. And God said, let there be dry land, and it was so. And God said, let there be living creatures, and it was so. It's not always like that with us, is it? I mean, what we say isn't always what we do. Now, Hugh, you said you'd help. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm afraid that was just my words speaking. Our words don't always match who we are, but God's do. So hear his word, and you hear God. If you're looking for God, start here with the Word and listen to it. Now, I admit you start to scratch your head a little as you read on. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Was with God? Was God? Which do you mean, John? Where do we look? It seems as if John is saying, you can't say anything different about God than you see and hear in the Word. He's got it all. And yet at the same time, he suggests God is bigger than just the Word. The one and only Son, as he turns out to be when you reach verse 14. He was God, and he was with God as well in the beginning. John's pointing us to the Trinity. In the beginning, God the Father created, Genesis 1. In the beginning was the Word, John 1. And through him, verse 3, through the Word, through the Son, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. They were in it together, Father and Son. Tim Chester, in his great little book, The One True Light, from which all the decent ideas in this sermon were nicked, he suggests the Father and Son were kind of working together as master designer and master workman, the agent who made it happen. And both delighting in what the others do. Oh, Father, I love what you're planning with those mountains, says the Son. And that waterfall's amazing. Son, that was just what I had in mind with the butterfly, says the Father as he sees one flutter by. Yeah, the Word is so intimately involved. If anyone can crack the code, he can. And here's one clue he has for us. Here's Jonathan Sacks writing again, warning a secular society. He says this, a creed that tells us that we're no more than selfish genes, with nothing in principle to separate us from the animals, in a society whose strongest motivators are money and success, in a universe that came into existence for no reason whatsoever and for no reason will one day cease to be, a creed like that, Sacks says, will never speak as strongly to the human spirit as one that tells us we are in the image and likeness of God in a universe he created in love. When that truth, when that value, that worth can be given to all of us, and not just to the strong and successful, to the weak and the ordinary, to the vulnerable child, to the fragile elderly, when, however dulled and dimmed and scarred that image has become, however awkward and weak and sick you may be, however much my history is full of 1,001 wrong choices, you know, my present riddled with tortured lifestyle battles, when we can still look at one another, any one another, when we can even look in the mirror, and that's the hardest thing for some, when we can even look in the mirror and know that under it all is a precious image bearer. And when that value, that worth has reached us, then looking for God, we may have found meaning for ourselves. A universal story, a creation story. Now, there's more still, though. It's also what I call the new creation story. In the beginning, God created. And Genesis goes on to tell us that on the sixth day, God said, let's make mankind in our image, and Adam, and then Eve, highlights the creation. In the beginning was the Word, says John. And by verse 14, he spills the beans. The Word became flesh. The code name's wearing thin. The Word is clearly Jesus. But there's more to Jesus, the Word become flesh, than just humanity, Mark 2. John isn't writing the story of creation. That's already been done. This is a new in the beginning story. This is the story of recreation, of new creation. Because you see, even back when John was writing, the world God made was no more. Oh, it was made good, very good, wonderful, beautiful. Still is good, very good, wonderful, beautiful in places. But it's also shot through with pain and evil and ugliness. It is broken. And John's writing the story of the Word, the Jesus who mends brokenness. Like most introductions, this one sets up the story that follows. The Jesus who recreates, who makes what's broken new. So as we read on, we'll read of the hungry fed, the sick healed, the lame walking, the blind seeing, the dead raised, the broken restored. Astonishing, isn't it, how often we churchgoers seem to close our eyes to this. You know, we act as if brokenness is a barrier. We try to hide it from a Jesus well able to restore us. And we certainly try and hide it from one another. These acts of recreation, of new creation from Jesus, give glimpses of a promised future. For if John starts by taking us back to in the beginning, he'll also point us forward to the new heaven and the new earth to come. The story stretches further back than Christmas and further forwards than Easter. And John doesn't want to leave us with a thin gospel. Now, I know all kinds of people talk big, make big claims. But this isn't a fairy tale story that John's writing. It's full of witnesses and testimony, and it speaks to your soul and my soul. A brokenness that can be restored. That's the kind of new creator we need. And then, breathtakingly, finally for this evening, he introduces the Word as the light for all. You see verse 4? In him was life. And what life, as we've seen. In him was life. But it wasn't kept to himself. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. You're looking for God? Start here. wherever you're coming from. C.S. Lewis echoed the truth of this verse when he said this once. He said, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. See, get this word, this Jesus in place, and it begins to throw light onto all there is of life. The word Jesus throws light on everything else, the dark as well as the light, the ugliness of life as well as its beauty. It brings meaning to a messy present as well as hope for an uncertain future. The light for all. Don't squeeze him into a narrow mold. The light of all mankind, and not the light for the religious, the light for the churchgoer, the light for the faithful few, but for all mankind. Now, of course, there is something uncomfortable about that idea, isn't there? You know, to find a value and a worth that I can give to myself and to any others around me may be a wonderful encouragement, but when you speak about the light for all, it sounds all too much as if the word provides that overarching narrative or storyline that so many postmoderns have got rid of. Sounds as if the word robs me of the freedom to give my life my meaning. Which is why we shrink from the idea of the word, any person being the light for all mankind. But think for a moment. You see, if the only meaning I can find for life is the meaning I give my life, then I'll live in a very small world, bound by my own horizons. The word brings a scope that's almost infinite. The striking thing is that Jesus enlarges our world. He doesn't shrivel it. And I know there are other alarm bells going off as well, because this all smacks of something controlling. These overarching narratives get used like that, as a kind of power play to get people to conform to a pattern that suits the people with the power. And religion has been used like that. All kinds of religions, and all shades of them. Actually, it still is being used like that. This story has hardly started, though. And as you read on, it doesn't fit the bill of any of the usual power plays. See, the all-creating word, the Jesus who put all things together. We'll read of him taking out a towel and washing his disciples' feet. Dirty, smelly, stepped in something feet. I tried to think, I don't think I've done that for anyone since our kids grew up and could wash their own feet. And it wasn't as if this was a one-off just for show act either. Jesus calls himself the Good Shepherd, and then he explains that the thing about a good shepherd is that a good shepherd will lay down his life for the sheep. And then he does it. Gives his life. It is nailed to a cross, the most shameful, agonizing of deaths, and all this not for himself, but for the sheep, to restore a broken world. But I'm racing ahead. You know, John's only started in his introduction. So, as we pause here for tonight, for this week, if you're looking for God, you start here, but keep reading. And if you'd like to read John's Gospel with someone else who might be able to give you a steer or two, just let me know. I'll be at the back afterwards, or happy to match you up. If you're looking for God, start here and keep reading. If you're speaking for God, start here. But keep God big enough if you're living for God. You start here and enjoy the adventure.